أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم محمد. ثم الصلاة والسلام على آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المظلومين، واللعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين من يوم عداوتهم إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله تبارك وتعالى في كتابه وهو أصدق القائلين، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم: واعتصموا بحبل الله جميعا ولا تفرقوا، واذكروا نعمة الله عليكم إذ كنتم أعداء فألف بين قلوبكم فأصبحتم بنعمته إخوانا وكنتم على شفا حفرة من النار فأنقذكم منها، كذلك يبين الله آياته لعلكم تهتدون. صلاة على محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
First night of Muharram, 1439 after Hijrah, and as is our custom, we begin the Muslim New Year not with celebration and rejoicing but with grieving, as we commemorate the martyrdom of the grandson of the Prophet of Islam, Aba Abdullah Sayyidu Shuhada Al Imam Al Hussein bin Ali alayhi afdalu salatu was salam. Sayyid ibn Tawus tells us that the sign of being loyal to the house of Zahra alayhi salam is that when the month of Muharram comes, there is a change in our lives, and that we rejoice when they rejoice and we grieve when they grieve. And we have many ahadith from the A'imma alayhimus salam that every one of our imams, as soon as the moon of Muharram was sighted, they put on black clothes, they stopped rejoicing or laughing, and they began mourning for their Jad Hussein until the day of Ashura. And they would hold majlises in their homes. So inshallah, in this spirit, we would do the same. And as part of marking these nights and commemorating them, we also seek to learn something from the teachings of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and promoting his message inshallah. You have heard in the introduction that the subject that we will be discussing inshallah is Orthodox Islam. I would like to use tonight's majlis as an introduction and in a sense set out the platform on which we will inshallah build the rest of the nights in these 12 nights inshallah. When we say Orthodox Islam, what we mean, at least for the purpose of this series, is that original Islam that Allah and His Messenger had intended for Muslims to follow. In a looser sense, we can define Orthodox Islam as mainstream Islam, as original Islam. The opposite of Orthodox would be heterodox, and it would suggest those who are heretical and those who break away from that original mainstream Orthodox Islam. Most of us do not choose what religion or what madhab we are born into, and so for many of us, we tend to grow into the same madhab that we were born into, and we defend and believe in all those teachings. But it is a sign of maturity and a sign of sincerity that one should understand why one follows the manhaj and the madhab that they do. And therefore, we want to ask this question to say, which version of Islam that we see in the world today in so many forms is that original orthodox Islam that Allah and His Messenger had intended for Muslims and for all of humanity. It is true that over 14 centuries there is a lot of cultural incursions that have taken place and come into all the different madhahib. So whether you are Sunni or Shia or any other sect of Islam, you could argue that the Islam you follow is not 100% exactly as the Islam that was introduced by Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam. But we seek to understand which madhab or which manhaj or which path should we follow that would be the closest to that Islam that Allah talks about in the Quran when He says, "Inna dina indallahi al-Islam." And the only way to do this is obviously to engage in some sort of inter or intra-faith dialogue where we understand and we seek to understand. Now, unfortunately, when we look at the history of these intra-faith dialogue that have taken place amongst Muslims, what we find is that most of the times there have been two approaches to these dialogues. One approach is very exclusivist, that starts on the basis that I am right, you are wrong, and I can say anything about you, mock, jeer, laugh, ridicule what you believe in, because I know I am right, and if you want to follow the truth, follow it, and if you don't, I don't really care. The other extreme has been a very pluralistic approach to say, we have been discussing the differences between us for 14 centuries and nothing has come out of it. It is about time that as Muslims we move on, and so we should stop discussing these issues. For how long will we keep talking about Ghadir and Saqifa and Badr and Uhud and Khandaq and so on and so forth? History is history. What has happened, we can't change that. But as Muslims, we are in a pitiful state in the world today, and therefore we need to look beyond history and move on. So this has been the other approach, to say, let us forget our differences and let us come together as one religion and focus on what is common between us and move on. The problem with that, as I shall demonstrate in these 12 nights, is that it actually does not resolve the problem. It just suppresses it and it festers as long as it is not discussed, and it is only a matter of time before it resurfaces. There is a third approach that I will be taking that is neither one that is high-handed, filled with hubris, nor the other that is very pluralistic and in a sense sweeping everything under the rug. And this approach is to say that a lot of times the misunderstandings we have amongst ourselves as Muslims is not because of what we say, but how we say it. And that we can learn as Muslims to have a very candid conversation, but one that is respectful. And this is not very difficult to understand. Supposing we had some strife and some tension in a relationship in our family, whether it is between us and our spouses or us and our parent or a sibling or a child. How do you resolve these differences? Let us suppose a man and his wife have a very troubled relationship in their marriage. Supposing they decide, let us not talk about it, let's just forget about it, that there was any differences between us. Is the problem going to go away? It's not going to go away. It will stay on both's minds and it will remain there, but the problem is not going to go away. Supposing they decide, let's talk about it, but the conversation is very high-handed and there's a lot of blame and abuse and pointing fingers. Is it going to solve anything? Well, it's predictable how that marriage is going to end. The only way that that relationship can be mended is if the two come together and say, look, we're both human, we both make mistakes. if we truly love each other and we want to repair this marriage, then let us talk to each other the language of love. So you both sit down, each one expresses their grievances, the other one listens to the other one, each one apologizes to the other, you seek to understand, and then you seek to be understood. And from there, that marriage can move on. The same things that were said in hostility are now being said again, but what has changed is how it is being said. In other words, I don't need to labor this point, but if we are to solve the problems in Islam today between the major sects in Islam, what is needed is this element of sincerity, of being genuine, of humility, of really wanting to reach out to each other with compassion, with empathy. And this is the language actually that the Quran teaches us. You see, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. He is the messenger of Allah. He is sent to polytheists. He knows what he is preaching is true and absolutely true. He has no doubt, and there is not an iota of doubt in his conviction that what he has is true. But look at what Allah tells him, that when you preach to the polytheist, what should you say to them? This is Surah Saba, chapter 34, verse 24. He says, first ask them, who is it that sustains you in the heavens and the earth? Is it not Allah? And then tell them, وَإِنَّا وَإِيَّاكُمْ لَعَلَىٰ هُدًى أَوْ فِي ضَلَالٍ مُبِينٍ. And you and us, either one of us is on guidance and the other one is on misguidance. This is the messenger of Allah. He is being told, don't tell them, I am guided and you are misguided. No. Tell them one of us is guided and one of us is misguided. Come, let us talk and find out. وَإِنَّا وَإِيَّاكُمْ لَعَلَىٰ هُدًى أَوْ فِي ضَلَالٍ مُبِينٍ. This is خَاتِمُ الْأَنْبِيَا. So Allah is teaching us the language we must speak. And this is not hidden from you that unfortunately, even amongst the Shia, we have groups that have chosen to promote the message of the Ahlul Bayt in a manner that serves no purpose. For example, the setting up of satellite channels where 24/7 all that happens is cursing. And cursing the individuals that our Sunni brothers and sisters look up to with a lot of respect. They were born into that faith and they were raised like that. Right? And then, celebrating and having a cake to celebrate the demise of Aisha, the wife of the Prophet, and clapping and dancing. And you have to question what is the intention behind that. You see, you have to remember that as we claim to be the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, we become the face, not the face of the Ahlul Bayt, but the face of their manhaj, the face of their mission. If someone is to decide, do I want to follow the Ahlul Bayt or not, there is no imam that they can look at. So they will look at the Shia and decide, do I want to follow the Ahlul Bayt or not? So if they are indeed superior, then that superior and superiority of theirs must shine and radiate through us, because we are the face of that. And a lot of times what happens is, when people discuss this, how should we discuss polemics and differences between us? What I hear is that the debate is around the fact that it puts the Shias in danger. This is what you commonly hear, isn't it? When people object to those who speak out against the early caliphs, for example, or the wives of the Prophet and so on, what do they say? They say, you guys in other parts of the world go up on the pulpit and you do la'an and you talk about all these things and you talk about the caliphs. The Shias in Pakistan and Afghanistan are being killed because of your words. So the concern is being expressed is what? Security. The opposite side, those who run these satellite channels and who say we should be free and open and just say the truth because the truth needs to be said, and if we don't say it, how will our children know the truth? Their argument is what? Their argument is they consider us to be kafir. Whether we say it or not, they're going to kill us anyway. So we might as well say it before we die. But you see, the argument is around what? The argument is about our lives and our security and the fact that we are being killed or not being killed. I want to change that perception and that conversation and say the argument is not about whether we are being endangered or not. The argument is that we have a responsibility, a taklif, to promote the Ahlul Bayt to the rest of the world. It is not about us and making ourselves feel good, that I feel good that I love Amirul Mu'mineen so much. It is about the fact that Amirul Mu'mineen will ask me Yawmul Qiyamah, what did you do to introduce me to others? And therefore, when the argument is like that, then it's a no-brainer. What is the best way to introduce the Ahlul Bayt? Because the Ahlul Bayt alayhimussalam themselves have said that humans by their nature and fitra have been wired to be attracted to us and to love us. You don't need to sell us to them. You simply need to introduce us to them. That's all. Let them know who Amir al-Mu'mineen is and then leave it to Allah. It's not your job to convert anyone. But you are the face, the person standing at the door that they first look at before they enter the room to be introduced to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. So it is very important then that we, you know, when we talk about what is the best way to approach, it is not about being validated. It is not the fact that we are in minority and we want the majority of the Muslims who are Sunni Muslims to accept us as, you know, being Muslims and not being kafir and as being another one of, you know, the fifth madhab and so on. It's not about validation. It's about the fact that we have to demonstrate the akhlaq of the Ahlul Bayt and we have an obligation to actively promote and introduce them to the rest of the world. And so how do we go about doing that? And so what I will do inshallah in these 12 nights is I will take the approach as follows. The first thing I want to do is discuss the major points of contention between the Shia and the Sunni. And because I speak obviously from the perspective of a Shia, what I will do is talk about all those issues that our Sunni brothers and sisters find objectionable about the Shias. And I want to respond to those very quickly between tonight and tomorrow night, no more than two or three nights. Thereafter, I want to derive from this a yardstick to say that if we are going to identify the orthodox Islam, the original Islam that Allah and His Messenger had intended, what should those parameters be? What should the yardstick be? How are we going to decide this is how we're going to measure to what degree are we following that orthodox Islam? And then finally, of course, we'll be coming to understanding then what is orthodox Islam. But what I want to also emphasize here is that the purpose of this whole discussion, because you will hear me tonight and tomorrow and in the first few nights discussing some very sensitive and contentious issues, and you will, you know, see a lot of polemics as well. And I'm going to do it as candidly as I can, but as respectfully as I can, inshallah. But I want to emphasize this, and I want you to bear this in mind throughout the series, inshallah, that the purpose of this discussion is not merely to determine which is the right path, because every side has this conviction that I am following the right path. The purpose of this discussion in determining orthodox Islam is that I wish to also demonstrate that the cause of suffering for Muslims in the world today is directly the result of having forgotten what orthodox Islam is. I want to show you that if Muslims are in a pitiful state today, it is because they are missing some very important ingredients that Allah and His Messenger had wanted Muslims to hold on to. So, side by side, as we determine orthodox Islam, we want to see how this is related to the plight of Muslims. I don't need again to sell this idea to you that Muslims are in a bad state and shape today, right? You may have sometimes played this game where someone says a word and you guess, you just say the first word that comes to your mind, isn't it? Someone says cat, you say dog. Someone says apple, you say orange. Someone says blue, you say red. If you speak to a non-Muslim and you say Muslim, what is the word they're going to reply?
Terrorist.
I was going to say that, but you all said it before I did. So we are all thinking the same way. We need to change that perception. We cannot simply say, well, they are wrong and they don't understand Islam. There is something we're doing wrong, which is why that is the word that comes to their mind. You know, many of you work in the corporate world, and if you work in the corporate world, you usually have this department that does, you know, surveys, right? Customer satisfaction surveys. And they have this term they use called NPS, Net Performer Score, isn't it? And if you have ever been asked to fill out a survey, you will see that any survey you fill out, there is one question towards the end, which is the primary NPS question. And the question is, would you recommend us to a friend or a colleague? Now, you think that's just one question on the survey. That is the question. That is the question that all corporations use to measure how they're doing. All their bonuses are driven by that. Their churn rate is driven by that. Their marketing strategy is driven by that. They have a way of saying, if we get a score of 7 and above, these are our promoters. If we get a score of, you know, less than 5 or 6, these are our detractors. These are the ones we need to go after. And then the others one are in the middle. And they have a formula they use to determine how they're doing based on this question. Now, obviously, Islam is not a corporation, but we need to be able to ask this question to a non-Muslim or to somebody who is newly introduced to Islam. Would you recommend Islam to a friend or a colleague? And I'm going to demonstrate to you, as you saw that the subject is In Search of Orthodox Islam, the difference that Adala and Imama make. I want to demonstrate that because we have lost these values like Adala and Imama, divine leadership and justice, this is the root cause of Muslim suffering today. And these were meant to be very much part and parcel of Orthodox Islam. If you can recite the salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The first issue we need to discuss is that the general assumption in scholars and the Muslim world is that because the Sunni Muslims are the majority, therefore that is mainstream Orthodox Islam, and that the Shias are a breakaway sect from that. Now, throughout this lecture, I will use the term Shia Islam, Sunni Islam. But I want to make it clear that I don't mean to suggest there are two versions of Islam, Shia and Sunni Islam. Nor do I intend to create that division. What I mean to say is that those who call themselves Sunni Muslims, they follow Islam, but they take their teachings through one set of sources. And those who call themselves Shia Muslims, when we say Shia Islam, we are referring to those Muslims who take their understanding of Islam from another source. And for the Shia, it's very simple, actually. That source is none other than the household of the Prophet of Ali Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. And so, even when you look at the works by university scholars and academics, you will find that there is this underlying messaging that because, and again, what is the percentages? These are the two major divisions of Islam. If you ask the Shia, they will say the Shias are probably 20%, 30% of Muslims. But we take a conservative estimate of even 10% or 15%. If you ask some of the more, some of the Sunni Muslims who are more opposed to the Shias, they will tell you the Shias are only 3% and the Sunni Muslims are 97%. Which in fact speaks to the credit of the Shia, that if the Shias today are seen as a major, you know, alternative to Sunni Islam, then how does this 3% stand before 97%? What is it that this 3% have that the 97% do not? But this is the general understanding, that the Prophet of Islam came, preached Islam, he passed away, the Muslims, Ummah, stayed together, And as this ummah progressed, because they spread out to different regions, different cultures, different ideas came introduced, groups began to break away. Just like you might have one major mosque or center, and then groups break out and form smaller forms and centers. So the same idea that the Khawarij became forming and the Shias came out and formed. And when you speak to a lot of individuals, and some of these are not necessarily, you know, Salafis or people who are just opposed to Shias. Some of these are, you know, very sincere, very learned individuals from Sunni Islam, you know. And I was recently reading a book by, you know, a Sunni scholar called Abdul Hakim Murad, whose, you know, pre-Islamic name was Timothy Winters. He's a respected academic scholar. He's translated books by Ghazali. And, you know, he writes the same idea that the Shias and the Khawarij broke away because they were, you know, unhappy with how things were, you know, being run in Islam. So there's different ideas. One is that there was a Jew by the name of Abdullah bin Sabah whose main focus was cursing the Sahaba, and he started this new cult that became Shia faith. Another is that the Shia faith started as a political group, and then it slowly crystallized into a full-formed sect with its fiqh and theology and so on and so forth. The other is the Shias were essentially an extremist group who had extremist ideas. They ascribed divinity to the Ahlul Bayt. They believed Imam Ali was divine and so on. And then with time, in order to survive, they toned down their extremism, and they took some theological ideas from the Mu'tazilites, and they borrowed and begged and took pieces from here and there, and they slowly formed into the religion that they have today. So this is the messaging. Now, we want to change that perception. And I want to argue, besides the fact that the majority does not necessarily mean that is Orthodox Islam, but I want to argue the fact that the Muslims that are majority today, they came about to be Sunni Muslims because of historic and socio-political reasons, not because of any religious or theological reason. Let me explain this. There was no major debate at some point where the Shia ulama and the Sunni ulama had this big debate, and the Sunni ulama completely trumped and defeated the Shia ulama, and then the majority went with this and the other ones were left behind. It wasn't like that. What I will demonstrate to you is that most people living in a society will follow the government of the time without standing up for any cause or fighting for anything that they see wrong in that society. Let's make it relevant and talk about the society we live in today. We live in Canada. We see a lot of things in the policies of this government that we like, that gives us the freedom, the security, the comfort, the benefits that we live in, alhamdulillah. But we see things that are wrong as well. How many of us stand up and protest about it? Right? For example, the government introduces gender-specific education to very young children. And some of that teachings we know are wrong and are corrupting the minds of our children. We're very concerned. But will we go downtown and protest and write petitions and write letters? No. Why? We're busy with our lives. We have to go to work. We have to put food on the table. We have, you know, dependents. We have responsibilities. There is no time for these sort of things. So we say, you know, others will do it. The government is trying to legalize pot. We all know it's wrong, right? We don't want marijuana legalized. But how many of us are going to write petitions and letters? No. Right? We just let things go. The government, when we came to Canada, many of us, there was no gay marriages. Now it is legalized. How many of us said anything about it? No. If you came a long time back, maybe there was a time when Canada had capital punishment, and then they removed it. Right? You can give example after example after example. Abortion, right? Pro-life, pro-choice. We see these things happening on a day-by-day basis. You hear in the news that the government is now, the province of Ontario, is going to allow alcohol and wine to be sold at the grocery stores. You don't want that. You don't want your children, when you go grocery shopping, seeing the bottles of wine and alcohol. But are you going to do anything about it? You let it go. You let this slide, you let that slide. Over a period of time, that way of life and that way of thinking becomes what is defined as quote-unquote Canadian values. And these are then infused into your children's minds, and they grow up with these ideas of what is human rights, what is feminism, what is animal rights, what is, you know, right and wrong about the environment, what should you stand up for, what should you not stand up for. And then you speak that language. When you get on social media, you blog, you write comments to every news article, you write based on what you have determined to be right and wrong, based on what society has fed you as values. But your fathers, when they saw these first creeping in, they kept quiet. So it went and you go with the flow. What I'm trying to say here is, this is the same thing that happened with Islam. The rights of the Ahlul Bayt, as we shall demonstrate, were usurped. They were marginalized and put aside and tormented and tortured. After the early caliphs, and particularly after Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, when the Umayyads came to power, they were brutally opposed to the Ahlul Bayt. And they also spread lies and rumors and fabricated false traditions to disparage Amir al-Mu'mineen and the Ahlul Bayt and to downplay their importance in Islam. And so the society grew up with those values. Now, those people for whom the caliph was Muawiyah, at that point, you wouldn't necessarily call them Sunni Muslim. But they are just Muslims living in different countries. They're living in Egypt, they're living in Syria, they're living in Iraq, they've probably never seen Muawiyah, but they know there is a caliph by that name. They never met Amir al-Mu'mineen, they never met the Prophet, right? The ahadith in praise of the Ahlul Bayt have been washed away, hidden, changed, forged, right? So they don't know any better, they go with the flow. You don't protest, you have a living to do. You have to go to work, you have to provide for your family, and things go one after the other. The Umayyads' rule comes to an end, the Abbasids come to rule. The Abbasids' rule comes to an end, the Ottomans come to rule. The Ottomans rule until the First World War, Second World War, the Khilafat comes to an end, countries break up, there's now nations with borders. But for the majority of the time, when the Muslim Ummah was growing and expanding in hundreds and thousands and millions, the government was determining what is going to be the official story of Islam. And what some of these caliphs did as well, as I shall demonstrate, is they also created a sanctity around the idea of the Sahaba and said that we must not speak any ill of any one of the companions of the Prophet, and create sort of an aura of infallibility around them. Why? Because if we allow investigations and discussions around them, even if they are true and honest, they might lead people back to seeing the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And they might now also point fingers at us that we are not as good as even the Sahaba Kiram. So we must somehow make them perfect, but at the same time we are claiming titles to be Khalifa of Allah and Khalifa of Rasul. So we must bring the Prophet down as well and show flaws in his character so that now we are worthy of being his Khalifa. Now this sounds like a conspiracy theory at this point, but I will abundantly prove this with evidence. The one advantage that the Shia Muslims have over the Sunni Muslims is that when the Shia Muslims argue their case, they bring their proofs and arguments from the Sunni sources. Because a lot of the early history, the Sirah of the Prophet ﷺ, were written by Muslims that you might today categorize as Sunni. So for example, Tariq Tabari, Tariq ibn Athir, Tafsir ibn Kathir, Suyuti, Ghazali, Tabaqat ibn Sa'ad, and there is a host of them, right? Sirah ibn Ishaq, Sirah ibn Hisham, none of these were Shias. So we use those very same sources to argue our case. But what we argue is we say, we must not bury our heads in the sand and pretend that there was nothing wrong. We must dig this out and talk about it. Not because we want to foster division and arguments, but because that is the only way to heal and understand what we lost in the original Islam, so that we can recalibrate our compass and find the way forward and solve the plight of the Muslims today. If you can recite the salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. You see, the Quran itself abundantly argues that the majority, for the most of times, is wrong. If you read the Quran, the language of the Quran always condemns the majority. We're not saying that this is proof that the Sunnis are wrong, the Shias are right. But we are saying it's not an argument that because you are the majority, therefore you must be right. Consider, for example, in Surah Al-An'am, chapter 6, verse 116, it says, وَإِن تُطِيعْ أَكْثَرَ مَن فِي الْأَرْضِ يُضِلُّكَ عَن سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. And if you were to follow most of those who are on the earth, they will take you away from the path of Allah. Right? إِن يَتَّبِعُونَ إِلَّا الذَّنَّ وَإِن هُمْ إِلَّا يَخْرُصُونَ. They follow nothing but suspicions, and they're only guessing their way through. It is only conjecture. So the Quran repeatedly argues this case. Now, I'm coming close to the end of my time for tonight, but I want to discuss one more thing here, and that is the issue of what is the origin of the words Shia and Sunni? And many of you have heard this time and time again, but I want to again substantiate this from the sources of our Sunni brothers and sisters. You see, again, the perception is that there was no such thing as Shia during the time of the Prophet. And that after the Prophet ﷺ passed away and the Muslims spread out, everyone was following Islam and there was only Muslims. And then this one group broke away and they began calling themselves Shia. However, when we go back to the sources of hadith for our Sunni brothers and sisters, what we find is this is actually not true at all. The word Sunni never existed, yes. But the word Shia existed and was used by the Prophet himself, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. One very, very, very popular example that you will find in many Sunni tafasir is that when you read Surah Al-Bayyinah, chapter 98 of the Quran, verse 7, the last verse, it says, إِنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ أُولَٰئِكَ هُمْ خَيْرُ الْبَرِيَّةِ. Those who have faith and do good, they are the best of creation. Many Sunni Mufassirun have reported this, that the Prophet ﷺ, when this verse was revealed, he said to the, he looked at Imam Ali ﷺ and said, O Ali, خَيْرُ الْبَرِيَّةِ is you and your Shia, the best of creation. And on many occasions when Amir al-Mu'mineen would approach the Prophet, he would say, Ja'a khairul bariya, the best of creation has now come. In another Sunni hadith, we are told that Salama, one of the wives of the Prophet, says, I was seated with the Prophet ﷺ, and with us was Ali and Fatima. And the Prophet raised his head and looked at Ali and said, Rejoice, O Ali, for you and your Shia will be in Jannah. This is a Sunni hadith. Now listen to this one. Al-Maghazili, Ibn al-Maghazili, al-Shafi'i, has a book called Al-Manaqib. It's a well-known Sunni source. He quotes a hadith from a companion of the Prophet called Anas bin Malik. Anas bin Malik says that the Prophet ﷺ said that 70,000 of my ummah will enter Jannah, will enter paradise without any hisab, without any accounting. And then he looked at Ali alayhi salam and said, O Ali, these are your Shia and you are their Imam. This is not a Shia source. So we find examples after examples where the Prophet says to Imam Ali, when he talks about Khairul Bariya, he says, Anta wa Shi'atuka yawmul qiyama radin mardiyin. Khairul Bariya, O Ali, is you and your Shia. You will be pleased with Allah and they will be pleased with you. Which means the verse that says, Radiallahu anhum wa radu anhu, is also about them. So we have lots of such examples that we find in this. Now, let me then explain how this idea came about. So, what we have understood so far is that in the time of the Prophet ﷺ, there was Muslims, and within the Muslims, there was a subset and a group who were very close to Amir al-Mu'mineen, and the Prophet pointed them out as the Shia of Ali. Now this Shia of Ali at the time of the Prophet were not a separate group that you could say there was two sects in Islam. There was the Muslims following the Prophet and there was the Shia following Ali. No, they were following the Prophet, but amongst them there were some who were identified as the Shia of Ali. It would be like saying amongst the Muslims, you have the Mu'mineen, you have the Muttaqeen, you have the Salihin, you have the Siddiqeen, you have the Zuhad, and then you say these were the Muttaqeen, but they were also Muslim. So they existed and were identified separately, but they're part of Islam, not a separate group. When the Prophet ﷺ passed away and the first caliph came to rule, the case continued like that. There was Muslims who were now told or following Abu Bakr as their caliph, but amongst the Muslims, there were some who were attached to Ali. They were known as his Shia. And the term Shi'at Ali remained in history. Second caliph, the same thing. Third caliph, the same thing. Now, when Imam Ali became the caliph, the whole Muslim ummah followed him. Those who are following him are all Muslims. But amongst those Muslims, there was still a group that was Shia. Can you see that until this point, there is no two sects? The Shias exist, but as part of the Muslim ummah, not as a separate sect. It was only when Muawiyah contested the right of Ali and said, "No, I refuse to pay allegiance to you," that the Muslim ummah split into two. And if you read the books of history, at that point, the Muslims were now divided into two groups. They were known as Shi'at Ali and Shi'at Muawiyah. So the term Shia was also used for the other group, but they were called Shi'at Muawiyah. Now, supposing, because Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he was leaving this world, he appointed Imam Hassan as his successor. And Imam Hassan alayhi salam was the caliph for 6 months. Supposing Muawiyah had not opposed Imam Ali, and the Khilafat would have continued in the descendants of Imam Ali, then to this day, what you would have seen in Islam is there would be one Muslim ummah, but within that ummah, there would have still existed an elite group that would have been pointed out as those who closely follow Amir al-Mu'mineen, and they are the Shia. But there would not be a separate group. But what happened was, when the Umayyads took the Khilafat, they severely opposed Amir al-Mu'mineen. They began cursing him from pulpits, and they began forging ahadith against him. And they marginalized and put aside the Shia and identified them as renegades and said, "These are heretics. This is a heterodoxy. These are the Rafidi." And so now they became mainstream Islam. And those who followed Ali now, who refused to accept that, they became the outcasts. Yes, there were other groups that broke away, like the Kharijites and so on. But you can see what has happened here. And in this political game, a lot of times it's all about marketing and labeling. If you label someone with something, they immediately detach themselves from it, and now they take on, if they can't detach themselves from it, they take on that label. So for example, if you speak against Zionism, and they label you and say anti-Semite, now that's a label in itself. If you're not smart enough to see that, you don't want to be called anti-Semite, isn't it? So you will do anything to show yourself as not being anti-Zionist, because you don't want that label. And so people will create these things like, you know, he's a homophobic, or he's Islamophobic, or he's this phobic and that phobic. And we don't like these terms. So now these terms came about. These are ghulu, these is, munafiqun, these are the breakaway sects, these are Majus, these are Rafidi, these are this and these are that. And then to again cement their position, over time, these titles changed from Shi'at Muawiyah, it became Ahlus Sunnah, and then it expanded and became Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah, and so on and so forth. But as I said, it is not that all the Sunni Muslims necessarily agreed with what Muawiyah preached, or what Harun al-Rashid did, or what Mutawakkil did. But when you live in a society, in a government, you go with the flow. You don't really oppose it. And this is how the majority came to follow that one path. It is because for the longest time, Muslims were ruled by tyrants and dictators. But that does not mean the majority is right, nor does it mean that the minority who voiced their opinion and opposed these tyrants are wrong. And so when we search for orthodox Islam, we must not judge it on the basis of majority or play with words and labels of saying, you know, how did the word Shia come about and how did the word Sunni come about? If you can recite the salawat ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. I think I have run out of my time for tonight, so we will stop here for tonight. And what we will now begin doing from tomorrow night, inshallah, is we will now begin discussing some of these contentious issues and saying, what are the things and reasons for which the Shias are seen as being a heterodoxy? What are the things that we are opposed for and said, you are not Muslims? You know, the Shias curse the Sahaba, the Shias, you know, practice mut'a, the Shias do this and the Shias do that, and all these things that are contentious. We'll very quickly review them, brief them, and then once we have done that, we are now in a better position to separate the lies from the facts and then say, what are really the fundamental issues on whose basis we should determine where does Orthodox Islam lie? And once we have done that, then for the rest of this ashara, what I will do, inshallah, is take you on a journey from the time of the Prophet ﷺ passing away to the present day Islam. And throughout this journey, as we explore all the different governments and Islamic movements and different ways of rules, we will keep looking at these yardsticks and measures of Orthodox Islam and say, if these had been present, what would have history looked like? And without these, how did history play out? And it will become clear to us as we approach the end, inshallah, that what is it that we are missing as Muslims and what is it we need to do to change our plight, inshallah. If you can recite As-salawat ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. صلى الله وسلم عليك يا أبا عبد الله روحي وأرواح العالمين لك الفداء يا ليتنا كنا معكم فنفوز فوزا عظيما. As we begin the month of Muharram, all months are the months of Hussein, and we cry for Sayyid al-Shuhada throughout the year. But there is a particular atmosphere that the month of Muharram brings that you have all begun to sense and feel. It is as if it is not just humans who weep for Hussein, but that the universe itself is crying out, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein. We cry for Hussein throughout the year, but you will find that in this particular month, it comes to us more naturally. Sometimes even during the day when we're just driving or just sitting by ourselves and we're just thinking of Imam al-Hussein, tears begin to flow from our eyes. There is a beautiful couplet in Urdu that captures this essence, and it says, "Ankho ke sahilo pe hai ashko ki ek hujum." Sahil, you know, sahil is a coast, an edge, the coast of our eyes. "Ankho ke sahilo pe hai ashko ki ek hujum, shayad ghame Hussein ka mausam qareeb hai." The poet says that all of a sudden I have begun to feel that my eyes well up and my eyes are invaded with tears. What is it that is happening? Perhaps it is a sign that the season of Hussein is now here. The days and nights to offer our condolences to the mother of Hussein. The days and nights to express our remorse and say, Abba Abdullah, if only we had been with you when you called out, Hal min nasirin yansurna. And our hearts bleed knowing that our Imam was by himself and kept calling out. And if only we could have been there. There are many different miracles that people speak of with regards to Imam al-Hussein and the Aza of Hussein. And I don't want to go into any of those miracles tonight, but I certainly want to mention two things about these majalis and the crying for Hussein that I find are miraculous in nature. The one thing that I find miraculous about this aza is that it never grows old. You see, any story that is told to you once, twice, three times, four times, you get bored with it. Even the story of your own father or your grandfather, If your story of your grandfather has been told you once, and even if he died tragically, once, twice, three times, four times, after a while, when it is told to you, you listen to it dispassionately. It is no longer of an appeal to you. But what is it with the tragedy of Karbala and the madlumiyah of Aba Abdullah that 1400 years have passed and you have lived for decades now, but every year when the day of Ashura comes, you want to listen to every single detail again. You want to hear every little bit of how Imam Hussein called for help. You want to hear how the throat of Asghar was pierced. You want to hear how Abbas fell from the horse. You want to hear how Hussein's body was trampled. What is it about this story that it never grows old? There is something miraculous about it. The other thing that is miraculous about the Aza of Hussein is that when you hear something horrific and tragic, it makes you restless, it makes you upset. But the gham of Hussein brings you tranquility. It brings you peace. You can lullaby a baby to sleep with Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein. It doesn't seem natural that when you speak of such tragedy, that people should feel a sense of, you know, calmness from within. There is a cathartic experience to listening to the Aza of Hussein. So I ask myself, what is it that makes this miraculous? One possible reason that we might say for this miraculous nature, that it never grows old for us, and that we always find we want to listen to the Aza of Hussein, is the ahadith that we have heard from the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt of how the Shia of the Prophet and his family are attached to them. For example, the hadith of the Prophet that says, "Inna liqatl al-Husayn hararatun fi qulub al-mu'minin." The Prophet says, in the killing of Hussein, there is a burning passion in the heart of the mu'minin. And there is nothing that will cool that fire in the heart of the mu'min. And then the other ahadith from the Imams that says, خُلِقُوا شِيعَتُنَا مِنْ فَاضِلِ تِينَتُنَا. Our Shias were created from what was left over from what we were created from. وَعُجِنُوا بِمَاءِ وِلَايَتِنَا. And their clay, when Allah created them, it was kneaded and washed in the water of our wilaya. So it becomes part of your nature and your fitrah. To a point that some ulama will tell you, that if a person is of a very high level of spirituality, he is so connected to the Imam of the time that sometimes he might feel sadness for no reason at all. There is nothing happening in his life, but he just feels really sad. And the reason is because his Imam is sad about something. And he is so connected that he imbibes within himself at an atomic level that connection to the Imam. There is another possible reason for this miraculous nature in the Aza of Hussein alayhi salam, and that is the fact that it is in the fitrah of all that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created. That everything that Allah has created has a connection to Hussein. We have this in the books of ahadith, not just for the Shia, but even amongst the Sunni. We have Ayatullah Firozabadi in his book Fada'ilul Khamsa fi Siha Sitta, the excellences of the Ahlul Kisa in the Siha Sitta. He narrates reports. He says, he shows us ahadith from Sunni sources that say, the jinn cry for Hussein, the malaika cry for Hussein, the hur al-ayn cry for Hussein, the beasts in the forest cry for Hussein, the fish in the oceans cry for Hussein, the birds in the skies cry for Hussein. Everything that Allah has created cries for Hussein. There is something about Hussein that is beyond human understanding. It is in the fitrah of humans. It is primordial for every creature to want Hussein to be a part of their lives. And therefore we are told in the books of ahadith that from the day Allah created this earth, He decided that every Anbiya will listen to the majlis of Hussein and cry. Adam alayhi salam came to this earth. Jibreel set him and told him the story of Hussein. Adam cried and cursed his killers. Nuh came on the ark Amidst the floods, Jibreel came to Nuh and told him the story of Hussein. He cursed the killers of Hussein. Ibrahim came and Ibrahim heard the majlis of Hussein. Musa was told the story of Hussein. Isa was told the story of Hussein. Anbiya after Anbiya, Rasul after Rasul, Yunus was told the story of Hussein. Every one of them, Yahya and Zachariah, cried for Hussein. When all had cried for Hussein, then Allah sent his final prophet. And when this final prophet was sent in the year 4 AH, Allah blessed Ali and Fatima with their second son. When Hussein alayhi salam was born on the seventh day, Rasulullah is holding his Hussein in his hand. He is kissing Hussein on his lips. He is holding his Hussein to his heart. Jibreel comes down to Rasulullah. O Ahmad, your Lord sends you salams. And your Lord says, you shall name this child Hussein. This is the Hussein that the universe has been waiting for. Now Jibreel is looking for a way to read this majlis to Rasulullah. So he sees Rasulullah kissing Hussein, hugging Hussein. He begins to weep. Rasulullah says, oh Jibreel, this is an occasion to be happy about. Why is it that you weep? Jibreel says, oh Ahmad, do you love this child? He said, by Allah, I love this child. He said, oh Ahmad, your ummah will kill this child after keeping him for 3 days thirsty. Rasulullah now sits. He is the azadar. Jibreel recites the majlis to Rasulullah. Rasulullah cries for Hussein. Jibreel leaves. Now Ali and Fatima come. They see Rasulullah is crying. So now Ali and Fatima are the azadar. Rasulullah reads the second majlis in Islam for Hussein. He begins telling them what will happen in Karbala and what will happen to Hussein. Jibreel gives Rasulullah some sand from Karbala and says, leave this behind. On the day that this sand begins to froth like blood, that is the day that your Hussein has been slaughtered. Rasulullah leaves this with Salama and says, oh Salama, when this changes to blood, then my Hussein has been killed. Ali and Fatima are now listening to the majlis of Hussein. Fatima is holding her Hussein and listening to how this ummah will slaughter her child. When she has heard this majlis and she has understood why Hussein must be sacrificed for Islam, she does not ask, Ya Abata, who will give kafan to my Hussein? She does not ask, Ya Rasulullah, who will bury my Hussein? She only asks, Ya Rasulullah, when my Hussein is killed, will you be there? No, O Fatima, I will not be there. Ya Rasulullah, I am the mother, will I be there? No, O Fatima, you will not be there in Karbala. Ya Rasulullah, will Abul Hasan be there? No, Abul Hasan will not be there. Then his older brother, Aba Muhammad al-Hasan will be there. No, Hasan will not be there. Now Fatima asks one question only. Abata, if none of us will be there, who will cry for my Hussein? Why? Because Fatima knows that if this will survive, it will survive through the tears of those who will cry for Hussein. Rasulullah assures Fatima, oh Fatima, Allah will create a qawm. Allah will bring forth a nation. Their men will cry for the men of Hussein. Their women will cry for the women of Hussein. Their children will cry for the children of Hussein. Fatima alayhi salam is now preoccupied with this child. The Ahlul Bayt are constantly concerned that this child must not cry and must not suffer in any manner. We are told in some of the books of history that sometimes when Rasulullah would be sitting in his masjid with his ashab and preaching to them, Fatima would dress up her sons Hassan and Hussein in new robes and then send them into the masjid. Hussein would come running into the masjid. As he runs into the masjid, he would trip on his robes and fall down. When Rasulullah would see his Hussein has fallen down, but he would stop his majlis. He would stop his lecture and say, bring my Hussein to me. Now the books of Hadith say the Ashab would carry Hussein from the back of the mosque. Everyone would carry the little Hussein, kiss him and pass him to the one in front. The next person would carry him and kiss him and pass him to the front. I would say, O Ummah of Muhammad, if only you would remember this on the day of Ashura. When Hussein would come to the front, Rasulullah would descend from the minbar. He would take his Hussein up. Then he would sit his Hussein on his lap and say to this Ummah, O people, Hada Husseinun fa'arifuhu. O people, this is my Hussein, recognize him. Don't forget, this is Hussein. Husseinun minni wa ana min al Hussein. O people, not only is Hussein from me, I am from Hussein. Ajrukum ala Allah. There came a day when Rasulullah was leaving this world. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam says, when he was taking his last breath, Hassan and Hussein went beside the Prophet. Hassan kept his head on one chest, on one side of the Prophet's chest, Hussein on the other. Rasulullah put his hands around his Hassan and Hussein. Amir al-Mu'mineen says, I tried to move the children away. Rasulullah said, no, Abul Hassan, leave my Hassan and Hussein. Let me smell the fragrance of Hussein once more. And the fragrance of my Hassan. This is the approach of Rasul and Ahlul Bayt for Hussein. A few months later, it was time for Fatima to leave this world. Some of the Arbab of Azaz say that one of the qualities of Imam al-Hussein was that he always felt thirsty. He was constantly thirsty. So some of the Arbab of Azaz say that when Fatima alayhi salam's ribs had been crushed, and when she went into the room and said to Asma, oh Asma, as long as you hear the voice of my tasbih, don't come into this room. Before she went into the room, she went and filled water in all the flasks in the house. Asma said, Bibi, why are you filling water in all these flasks? She said, my Hussein is always thirsty. I do not want him to be thirsty and there is no water in the house. Ajrukum ala Allah. When Fatima alayhi salam left this world, Amir al-Mu'mineen says, I washed the body of Fatima and shrouded it. I put it in a room, then I called the children and I said, O Hassan and O Hussein, O Zainab and Kulthum, come for wida. This is the last time you will see your mother. Sheikh Allama Majlisi says in Bihar, when Hussein alayhi salam came for wida to his mother, he did not come and approach his mother immediately. He stood in the corner of the room and kept looking at the body of his mother. Amir al-Mu'mineen says, by Allah, the hands of Fatima came out from the coffin as if saying, come, O Hussein, come do wida to your mother for the last time. Abul Hassan, Amir al-Mu'mineen says, by Allah, I heard a voice from the heaven saying, Abul Hassan, move Hussein, for Allah, by Allah, the angels are weeping. This Hussein has always lived in Medina. This Hussein has always gone to the qabr of his mother Fatima. Now it is time for Hussein to leave Medina. The year 68. The month of Rajab, Hussein alayhi salam, he is sitting in Masjid al-Nabawi. It is time for Maghrib, he is praying Salat. A messenger comes to him and says, Aba Abdullah, the governor of Medina summons you immediately. He asks that you come to him in the middle of the night. You come with him, with me immediately to see him. Hussein alayhi salam knows all is not well. He says to the messenger, go back and say to Walid bin Utba, I will come shortly after I am done with my prayers. Hussein alayhi salam goes back to his house. It is not common for a governor to call you in the middle of the night to his palace. He begins to call all the young men of the Banu Hashim, O Abbas, O Qasim, the brothers of Abbas, O Ali ibn al-Akbar, come with me. They all take their swords. Hussein comes to the palace of Walid. He asks this Shabab of Banu Hashim, wait outside. Do not come in unless you hear me calling you. When Hussein enters, he sees Walid sitting on a throne. Besides him is the wretched Marwan ibn al-Hakam. Walid says to Imam al-Hussein, we have received news that Muawiyah has died in Damascus. Imam al-Hussein recites the ayat of Tarjih, Inna lillah. Then Walid says, Yazid has now taken on the Khilafah. And Yazid has sent this letter that he shows Imam al-Hussein. And the letter says that Hussein must now pledge allegiance to me as the caliph, and if he does not, he must be put to death. When Imam al-Hussein hears this, he says to Walid, it is not appropriate that a man like me should pledge allegiance in the middle of the night enclosed behind closed doors. If you have something to ask me in bright day in public and you will have my answer. Marwan ibn al-Hakam, who knows Imam al-Hussein, he says to Walid, O Walid, this is the son of Ali. If you do not take bay'ah from Hussein now, you will never get Hussein again. Force him to give you bay'ah now or you must behead him right now. At this point, the son of Zahra is enraged. He turns to Marwan ibn al-Hakam. He says, أَأَنْتَ تَقْتُلُنِي يَبْنَ الزَّرْقَىٰ أَمْ هُوَ Will you, the son of an unchaste woman, kill me or will this man kill me? But as soon as the voice of Hussein was raised, the doors flung open. Abbas came in with a naked sword. Did you call us, O Mawla? Abbas, this is what Hussein will call out for on the day of Ashura. Hussein takes his young man back with him. Walid and Marwan know they cannot force Hussein. Hussein goes back home and speaks to his family. He tells them, the time has come now to leave Medina. They decide who will remain in Medina and who will go. Some of the women are left behind, Salma and Ummul Baneen. Abdullah bin Ja'far and Muhammad al-Hanafiya, Fatima Sughra, these remain behind. The rest are to leave with Hussein. Hussein asks them to get ready to leave the next day as arrangements and preparations are being made. Sheikh Saduq says in his Amali, he says Hussein decides he will go for one final ziyarah to the qabr of Rasulullah. Hussein knows he is now leaving Medina and he will never return to Medina again. Sheikh Saduq says Imam al-Hussein goes to the qabr of Rasulullah. He cries at the grave of his jad. Then he goes into sujood. For a long time Hussein is in sujood. While he is in prostration, Sheikh Saduq says Imam Hussein has a vision. He has a mukashafa. He sees his grandfather standing before him. He cries to Rasulullah and says, O Rasulullah, O jad, it is time for me to leave Medina. I do not wish to be separated from you. Why do you not pray to Allah that I should not leave Medina? Rasulullah says to him, O Hussein, ka'anni araka murammilun bidamik. O Hussein, it is as if I can see you now rolling in your blood. O Hussein, inna laka darajatan indallah, la tanaluhu illa bish shahada. O Hussein, you have a status with your Lord. You will not attain this except through martyrdom. Go towards Iraq, O my Hussein. It is time for you to leave. Hussein returns home. Preparations are being made. The ladies are getting ready to leave. Amir al-Mu'mineen's policy was that the women of his household should not be seen by strangers. In particular, he protected Zainab and Kulthum. It was the policy of Amir al-Mu'mineen that even when he went to Kufa, he told Imam Hassan, when you bring Zainab and Kulthum to Kufa, when you get to Kufa, don't enter Kufa during the daytime. Wait outside Kufa until it is night. Bring my Zainab to Kufa in the dark of the night. Someone announces in Medina, the daughters of Rasulullah are now leaving their homes. Lower your gaze and move away. Qasim comes forward to hold the reins of the camel. Ali ibn al-Akbar comes and holds the hand of his aunt Zainab. Abbas comes forward and kneels down and puts his knee forward for Zainab to mount the camel. This is what Zainab will look for on the day after Ashura. She will turn towards Furat and say, Abbas, you are the one who helped me get on the camel in Medina. Zainab and Kulthum and all get ready to leave. When this qafila is about to leave, others are trying to stop Hussein from leaving. Abdullah ibn Abbas comes to Imam al-Hussein and says, Ya Aba Abdullah, why do you not stay in Medina? We will fight from Medina and defend you. Imam al-Hussein says, No, Ya Ibn Abbas, this is something that has been foreordained. Inna Allah sha'a an yarani qatila. Allah wishes to see me being killed. He says, Then go, O Hussein, but why do you take Zainab with you? He says, Inna Allah sha'a an yarahunna sabaya. O Ibn Abbas, Allah also wishes to see them captives. O Ibn Abbas, you cannot stop us from this now. Hussein is getting ready to leave. The Arbab of Azar say the last thing that Hussein did was he went to Jannatul Baqi. Hussein now went for wida to his mother. Hussein went to the qabr of his brother Hassan. Then he came to his mother Zahra. I do not know what Hussein said to his mother Fatima. Perhaps he said, Amma, I have come for you to you for salam every day. Amma Hussein is leaving Medina. Amma Hussein will not come and say salam again. Amma, this is wida, I am leaving. I would not be surprised if a voice would call out from the qabr of Fatima, Oh Hussein, I am leaving Medina with you as well. Oh Hussein, go forth to Iraq, and wherever you go, Zahra will follow you. Ala la'natullahi ala al-qawm al-zalimeen, wa Husayna, wa madluma, ma tamih Hussein.